What could be more democratic than calling a referendum, you know, asking the people to decide? It's what Egypt just did. Egyptians voted overwhelmingly for constitutional changes that could allow President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to rule until 2030. It's what Ireland is preparing to do next month in a referendum that would regulate divorce. And it's what Britain did, of course, 3 years ago with Brexit. The question then was simple enough: stay in the European Union or leave, except that now it's not so simple, since Parliament's gridlocked over how to leave. Ah, yes, the unintended consequences of a referendum. We'll hear more on that theme in just a bit as we spend the next few minutes on the show on this idea of referendums. First, the reaction from many Brits to this Brexit impasse is, shouldn't there just be a second referendum? You know, another chance for the people to decide. It's not just Brits raising those questions. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
I don't like telling my friends that I work for an international news show because stuff like this happens.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Should I ask my question?
This is my friend Becca Becht. We met when we were teenagers, and you can hear that we still act that way. But now she's a fancy lawyer in Boston. Okay, back to Becca's question.
Why can't they just do a second Brexit referendum?
I tried my best to answer, but it wasn't pretty. But then I remembered something I heard British Prime Minister Theresa May say about just this issue.
Finally, let us not break faith with the British people by trying to stage another referendum. Yeah. Another vote which would do irreparable damage to the integrity of our politics. Because it would say to millions who trusted in democracy that our democracy does not deliver.
So I sum that up for Becca.
It's undemocratic because, I mean, you can't be seen as taking the referendum is the will of the people, and if you just like do a second one, it would be like you're undoing it.
So, but what's the point of taking a measurement of the will of the people through a referendum if you can't do it again? Isn't a newer temperature of the people more valid than an old one?
Yeah, I told you she was a good lawyer.
Okay, let me take this to some British people and see what they say.
Awesome.
And so I called the BBC's Rob Watson, who has the unenviable job of explaining British politics to mainly non-British people.
At this point, the reason why there isn't going to be a second referendum is because the majority of Britain's politicians can't agree that there should be one.
Makes sense. After all, we in the States are no strangers to congressional gridlock. But Rob says that can all change the longer the country's stuck in Brexit purgatory.
As they see the sort of chaos of the Brexit process, you know, you're likely to get more and more MPs switching to say, you know what, uncomfortable as we are with the idea of another vote, maybe it does make more sense.
So all of this is about parliamentary math. But for me, the more interesting question is the philosophical one. Would a second referendum be undemocratic in principle? And for that, I turned to political philosopher Erin Kelly at Tufts University. She said that according to the theory of deliberative democracy, a second referendum would be even more democratic because the people have had time to reflect and come to a more informed decision.
I don't think that a population considering and discussing a very important, consequential political question together over time, over the course of 3 years, and reforming their opinion and wanting to express it through a democratic process with a possible different outcome is, in principle, objectionable.
All right. I think it's time to report back to Becca.
Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Bex. Okay, so I have some answers to your referendum questions. Okay, so from what I can tell, they are having an issue getting any kind of clear majority behind it because some MPs are...
So I went over the whole thing.
Vote. Other ones say,
thank you.
You know, let me know if there are any other questions that I can answer for you.
Yeah, actually, I was wondering what is going on with this comedian who just won a landslide in Ukraine?
Ugh, never tell friends you work at the World. For the World. I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Okay, so back to that idea of holding a second referendum to decide something the first one didn't quite settle. There's a place where they've tried that, Quebec. The predominantly French-speaking province twice held votes on whether to separate from the rest of Canada and become its own nation. These votes were divisive, but the changes that came in their wake weren't all bad. Emma Jacobs reports from Montreal.
A musician is playing for tourists in front of the Notre Dame Basilica in the historic center of Montreal. This is where I meet Mario Pelez, an emeritus professor of urban economics at the research institute INRS. He says that a century ago,
this was kind of this Wall Street, St. James Street. It has all these wonderful old buildings with Greek columns, which is what, you know, important and serious banks should look like.
All Canada's major banks and insurance companies had their headquarters here. The people who ran these institutions spoke English, even though most people living in Quebec spoke French. That led to stark income inequality between English speakers and French speakers, which contributed to Quebec nationalism and a separatist movement that grew in the 60s and was even endorsed by French President Charles de Gaulle. It culminated with the victory of the Parti Québécois in 1976 in provincial elections. The party promised a referendum on independence within its first term. But not everyone was happy about this, says Mario Pelez.
Businessmen, and bankers especially, hate uncertainty. They don't hate uncertainty.
If Quebec separated from Canada, could they move their employees easily between cities? Quebec separatists said that they wanted to keep Canadian currency, but if that didn't work out, a Quebec currency would be much weaker.
So if you were a bank, that uncertainty certainly would cause you to think twice about staying here.
The Parti Québécois also passed a law that made French Quebec's only official language, limiting English in workplaces and even on shop signs.
It's difficult to factor out which one is more important, the fear of eventual separation or the fact that all of a sudden the English language had lost its dominant status.
An exodus began. The Sun Life Insurance Company had a towering building here, but in 1978, Sun Life announced it would move its headquarters to Toronto. That English-speaking city was already competing with Montreal for big business. Now other companies followed. In 1980, the separatists had the referendum and lost. Quebec remained part of Canada. But Bay Street in Toronto kept Canada's financial hub. Some 200,000 residents also left Quebec for English-speaking provinces during these years, a brain drain that also hurt Montreal's economy. But Pelez points to the glass towers around us.
In 1960, there was no such thing as a big French-Canadian company. Well, today, where you're standing, you know, French Canada has given rise to a whole bunch of multinationals.
In sectors like insurance, construction, engineering, by the mid-90s, a second referendum on separation had hardly any measurable economic impact. Most companies that would have considered leaving had already done so. They left Montreal a second-tier financial city, but its overall economy has recovered. And
Quebec succeeded in doing, I call it a miracle. It is a miracle, okay?
That income gap between English speakers and French speakers, he says, has all but disappeared. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs.
The World's history guy, Chris Wolf, joins me now to talk about, is it referendums or referenda?
Well, I was actually shocked to learn, Marco, it's actually referendums. It's incorrectly assumed that it's a Latin noun, but it's not. It's actually a new English word that was coined a couple of hundred years ago using the word refer and a fancy Latin-sounding ending.
So there's this kind of fake Latin connection to the word referendum, but does that mean that the ancient Romans did not have referendums?
Well, they did kind of. In the Roman Republic, they certainly enjoyed consulting the people. The Senate and the consuls ran the joint, but they, for vitally important questions in the Republic, like war and peace or land reform, they would try and get buy-in from the masses by either the citizens assembling in committee or in the forum itself. By the way, a decree from the Committee of the Plebs is a plebiscite, which is another word for referendum, but it meant something different in the Roman times.
So you gave us the linguistic side of referendum. What exactly is it, anyway?
In one sentence, Marco, a referendum is a vote by the electorate on a single political question.
So were the Romans the first people to make these attempts at direct democracy?
Well, I would think not. Since humans have gathered into bands, it's been smart political leadership to get buy-in for difficult decisions by asking people what they want to do. You know, where are we going to hunt this year? That kind of thing. But the practice obviously wasn't too welcome among kings and princes, so it kind of vanished from organized states once they were established until the 1500s. And that's when we find the first example of a referendum, and in fact the first use of the word in the modern sense, in a little canton in Switzerland called Graubünden. It became quite the thing in Switzerland, in fact, as a confederation of mini states. They had some of those echoes of Roman and ancient Greece, but it was really only found there until the late 1700s.
And then what happened?
Well, remember the French Revolution?
Your Majesty, I must have a word with you. Ah! I've come on the most urgent of business. It is said that the people are revolting.
You said it. They stink on ice.
That's for those of you who get your history of the world from Mel Brooks. But the modern revival of referendums, as it were, came with the advent of the Enlightenment in Europe, the idea of popular sovereignty, that power comes from the consent of the governed, not from God. And the French revolutionaries took this good idea of listening to the will of the people and made it a terrible way to change your constitution. The experience shows, I think, one of those core weaknesses of the referendum, that it's also its main advantage. It's a good way to legitimize dramatic change, for good or bad. And within a few years, referendums were being abused by Napoleon to make himself consul for life and then emperor.
Yeah, so in some circles, referendums are not well regarded.
Not at all. When I was studying politics and government in the 1980s in the UK, they were really frowned on. My teachers could remember voices like this.
In cui Roma aveva Cesare, Virgilio ed Augusto.
Benito Mussolini was dictator of Italy from the 1920s to the 1940s. He turned elections into plebiscites where you could approve or disapprove of a single list of candidates. Then there was this.
When Hitler goes to vote for himself, the cheers speak louder than words. All Germany seems to be anxious to show its solidarity behind the dictator and its approval of his policy.
What policy was that?
Well, in this particular instance, that's the occupation of the Rhineland in defiance of international law in 1936. And I think it's good to remember that Hitler did not have absolute power immediately. He had to progressively demolish constraints on his power and weaken and eliminate other sources of power, whether it's the legislature or the judiciary or the unions or even international law. And one of his tools for doing that was the referendum, the plebiscite. For example, in 1934, a plebiscite was used to merge the offices of president and chancellor.
So not a great history there, but these days referendums seem to be everywhere around the globe.
Well, they seem to have been rehabilitated, but they're still problematic, especially when they're not authorized by a central government, but by, say, a regional minority. In Catalonia in 2017, the celebrations were followed by clashes with police and the imposition of direct rule from Madrid. There was a similar fiasco in Iraqi Kurdistan the same year.
In a controversial and some say illegal vote, 90% of Iraqi Kurds who have been America's closest partners in the fight have voted for independence from the Iraqi government.
That vote was eventually ignored, but only after the central government in Baghdad had threatened war. So that's another warning about these referendums. They can be useful, but they're also divisive and dangerous.
What is the U.S. record on referendums, Chris?
Well, of course, the U.S. was born out of that Enlightenment we talked about in Europe and the idea of popular sovereignty, which is the foundation of the U.S. Constitution. Yet the Founding Fathers very deliberately rejected any notion of direct democracy. They very much believed in something quite different, what political scientists call representative democracy, where you elect representatives and they then make their own judgment about issues. So it got off to a slow start. But then in 1898, South Dakota introduces the referendum, and they slowly take off through the western states, now accepted by 24 states in the Union. But of course, there's no provision for a national referendum or even a recall.
Chris, a final thought on referendums? What strikes you?
Well, I think an election or a vote, it's supposed to reflect the will of the people, and that should be respected. But they're only as good as they're designed. For example, a hugely complex question like leaving the European Union, a semi-federal entity, was framed as a simple, like, kind of leave-stay question. So there was enough people wanting to leave. But as we've seen, absolutely no agreement on when or how, which kind of explains how we're in this pickle now.
The world's Chris Wolfe. Thank you. Shall we stop chatting now? Yes? No?
Let's let the listeners decide.
You know, if you go digging, there are some pretty odd laws in the books. What is the weirdest referendum you've come across?
Well, I think the prize has to go to Saskatoon in Canada, which in 1997 had the very interesting referendum on to decide in municipal toilets which way the toilet paper should come off the roll. Should it be over or under? One of those key debates of our time. They voted 4-1 in favour of toilet paper coming over. To be serious, they just wanted to test new voting equipment and thought this would be a fun way to try that.